Welcome to The Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the pioneers of forensic science and techniques that were used to catch murderers. We will talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We will also discuss times where science, or the people wielding it, failed. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of the science of murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. In my daily life, I'm a medical laboratory scientist. My profession is grounded in the how and why of biological and chemical data. I'm someone who looks at a clinical result and tries to see the human story behind the numbers. That's kind of how I look at these cases. I am curiously fascinated in the how and why these crimes happen, and how science has developed to catch and convict the offenders. I'm here to open up those conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. Today, we're going on a bit of a side quest. I recently posted my 15th episode, and my birthday is this month. So I'm going to talk about some of my favorite forensic topics and related interests. For this week and next week, I'm going to detour from the true crime world to talk about my favorite related fictional media. Cozy mysteries, police procedurals, brain teasers, and the exploration of justice, whether fictional or true crime. A lot of people spend a lot of their free time on these topics. I obviously do. So, as I always say, I know I'm not the only one out here fascinated by the science of murder and true crime, so I want to share some of my favorites with you. To set the stage, I've always been a voracious reader. My library is a mix of every genre imaginable. My husband once joked while seeing me deeply immersed in my tablet, asked me if I was reading smut again. I had to look up and tell him that actually I was currently deep into a peer-reviewed study on the effects of salinity on sun-dried tomatoes. But the truth is, I do read the smut too. I used to burn through a Harlequin romance in the 90 minutes between a grueling class and an afternoon lab as a palate cleanser, just to shut out the world and give my brain a reprieve through Happily Ever After. I don't just read books. I devour them. Well, some people set a goal to read 20 books in a year. I'm the girl who's done that in a single weekend. It's my total immersion mode. But the brain doesn't necessarily power down while reading. Sometimes, even in the middle of the story, I'm the girl who wonders if she could be the one to finally decipher the zodiac ciphers. I'm the one looking past the narrative and into the mechanics of the crime, and the psychology of the victims, the perpetrators, and the bystanders. The authors and stories I favor are immersive mysteries, stories about the human condition, or a new tidbit of science that I didn't know before. In that vein, when we talk about the architecture of a mystery, we have to start on a train. Picture the elegance of the Orient Express. It is the ultimate visual, almost otherworldly. It's snowbound, it's elegant, and it is a perfectly closed system. Agatha Christie invites us all aboard, and then she hands us 13 suspects for a murder resulting from 12 stab wounds. It's a masterpiece of investigation because it draws you in with the classic Poirot flair, making you feel like you're part of the hunt. It's a gorgeous hook. And even though it's not my personal favorite story of hers, it's a great visual of mystery that everyone recognizes. It sets the stage for what an investigation should be. A search for the truth, even when the world has come to a standstill. My own introduction to Christie was early. I was in 7th grade. That year, I attended 4 different schools. And in the 3rd one, we were assigned, and then there were none, as an English requirement. To this day, it is one of my favorite stories. It's twisty and fun, a classic whodunit that boggles your mind, teases you with metaphors and a nursery rhyme, and manages to deliver the ultimate sense of justice. But the real reason Christie is the queen of mysteries isn't just because she was clever. It's because of who she was before she was a famous writer. And who she became when her own world fell apart. She started writing her first book, The Mysterious Affair at Stiles, in 1916 while working at a dispensary during World War I. She was learning toxicology and handling poisons on a daily basis. And let's be real, between a world war and a marriage that would eventually leave her shell-shocked and divorced, she probably felt a bit vindictive. Who wouldn't? But if Agatha Christie was going to do something, she was going to do it absolutely well. She took that dark energy and those lethal reagents, and she turned them into beautifully constructed, engaging mysteries. She used accuracy as a plot device because she refused to be sloppy with the truth. In a Christie novel, the chemistry and physics dictate the narrative. If a specific poison takes a half hour to act and your suspect has a 4-hour alibi, they are scientifically innocent. Period. It's the same logic I use at my clinical bench every day. When everything else is shifting, the metabolic timeline and the chemical markers are the only things that stay true. The power of that kind of precision isn't just there theoretical. In 1977, a nurse reading The Pale Horse recognized the symptoms of thallium poisoning in a dying patient that the doctors had missed. Because Christie insisted on being accurate to the science, that nurse had a diagnostic clue she needed to save a life. That is the beauty of doing the work absolutely well. I didn't discover logic and science and the human elements of mystery with Christie. She was just the best, and honestly, still is. As a kid, I was trying to find the evidence with Encyclopedia Brown and learning the human condition with Little Women. I wanted to know everything. I was the kid who wanted to be a doctor, but I also wanted to be an astronaut. The plan was simply that I was going to be a doctor in space. I wasn't going to give up either one just because they were difficult. I was insatiable for knowledge, and have been from the start. I remember my kindergarten teacher being completely shocked when she realized that I could already read. She hadn't seen it coming, but once that door was open, I never stopped. Libraries weren't just schoolrooms or public buildings to me. They were a sanctuary. That sanctuary gave me a book that shaped my entire backup plan. From the mixed-up files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler, I became obsessed with the idea of living invisibly in the tunnels under the Museum of Natural History. Honestly, that or the tunnels of the Smithsonian still seem like a viable backup plan. I wanted to be among the archives and the dinosaurs, surrounded by the exhibits and with access to all the artifacts. While everyone else was looking at the exhibits from behind the velvet ropes, I wanted to be the one who knew where every discovery was tagged and how the whole system breathed. And of course, I wanted to solve a mystery like Claudia, to find that one piece of evidence, that one hidden signature that changes the entire history of the record. By the time I hit fifth grade, I was already familiar with the weight of being the weird kid. I was a semi-isolated child genius with family issues, completely bored in any class that wasn't one-on-one, and then my body decided to complicate things even further. Puberty came with a 9-inch summer growth spurt that combined with hypermobility meant that my joints were physically separating. The pain was constant, and it limited my ability to participate in the physical world that other kids took for granted. When your body becomes a source of pain and your social world is limited by your own brain, keeping that brain occupied isn't just a hobby. It's survival. My fifth grade teacher mostly didn't know what to do with a student who had already finished most of the district's curriculum. She had a whole classroom to manage. So, keep me busy, she gave me a small billboard on the side of the classroom to decorate. I turned that billboard into what was practically a shrine for the Challenger mission. I had my die-cast model of the Columbia and my March 1981 National Geographic with a giant, detailed, fold-out diagram of the orbiter. I spent hours memorizing those schematics, pinning science facts to that wall like I was building a sacred archive. We were all enraptured by it, on some level. The whole country was invested because this was a deeply human story. Krista McAuliffe was going to teach us from space. Our teachers, our parents, everyone fostered this idea that we were all going together. And then we watched it blow up on live TV. In that moment, 73 seconds from liftoff, the science didn't matter. It wasn't about O-rings or fuel tanks right then. It was the sudden, violent realization that these people, the ones we were all rooting for, had been stolen away. Later, when the investigation started and I saw how the mechanical failures were picked apart, I realized that the only way to make sense of the loss was to understand the breakdown. I am still a girl who throws herself completely into her interests and wants to know everything about them, even the flaws. Because when science fails or we fail the science, human lives are the cost. That's why I do this podcast. I'm asking the core questions. How do we work? Why do we work? And what happens to the human ledger when the system breaks? In that idea, I discovered my next favorite author, Michael Crichton. Years later, he reminded me that even the most perfect system has a breaking point. It was a cold echo of the lesson I'd learned in fifth grade. No matter how beautiful the machine, the flaws are what dictate the outcome. during my pre-med years, before I discovered that my current career even existed, I was living at home, going to college, holding down a near full-time job, and acting as a caregiver for my critically ill grandfather. There was so much going on, but I'm not a person who ever really learned how to relax and just let go. My main escape was the one I'd always had, books. I would regularly walk into a bookstore and essentially drop most of a week's pay on a stack of novels, moving through one author after another. I'd go through the suspense of Mary Higgins Clark or the weirdness of Dean Koontz, but it was Crichton that really locked in. I'd read Jurassic Park a few years before, but then I found Sphere, The Andromeda Strain, and Congo. Crichton was a prophet. When I read The Andromeda Strain, I wasn't just reading a thriller. I was looking at the blueprint for an automated lab 30 years before it became reality. He understood the absolute precision of the sealed room and the robotic arm, but he was also obsessed with the flaws. He understood the ooh, shiny factor better than anyone. He knew that for people like us, ethics matter deeply, but also dinosaurs! He hooked us with the wonder of the, can we? With high-tech labs and prehistoric revival, only to hit us with the, should we? That is the essence of the Ian Malcolm principle. In Jurassic Park, the system didn't just fail because of a storm. It failed because of human greed and human error. It was the frog DNA zebra. The tiny, overlooked biological variable that the creators thought they had controlled, but which ultimately rewrote the entire system. It was in literally only counting on the expected variables and not the unexpected. Crichton's work is a masterclass in the how of the breakdown. He reminds us that you can have the best intentions and the most advanced technology, but if you ignore the small technical truth or the biological reality, the system will eat itself. In the lab, we rely on the system to be perfect, but we are always looking for that one reagent that's off, or the one human choice that bypasses the protocol. Crichton proved that if you want to solve a mystery or prevent a catastrophe, you have to be willing to look at the broken parts of the machine with the same intensity you used to admire its beauty. My near-obsessive need to always keep learning is why I've always read everything I can get my hands on. Science, human nature, thrillers, romance, whatever, I don't discriminate. I'm just looking for the logic of how things work and how they fail. But when you spend your life absorbing that much information, your head gets a little clouded. I think about listening to Bailey Sarian talking about how she binged all of the Chris Watts case material, every interview, every document, every scrap of video. She just reached a point where she had to talk about it. She had to get it out of her system. I feel that same way with a different layer of data. For me, it's not the fame or the story. It's because in my real life job, I work in a lab where we produce 70% of the data in your medical record, yet are mostly invisible. I have the equivalent of Bailey's Chris Watts information in my head, but focused on volumes of toxicology, pathology, and the technical reality of systemic breakdown. This podcast is the structured output I need to process and share all of that data. It's how I take the technical reality of what I know and learn and speak it into the world, so it isn't just sitting here with me in the dark. As I've been saying, years before I ever found my place in the lab, I was a voracious consumer of stories. I was always looking for relatable people and engaging stories to feed a curiosity that never shuts off. I wanted to see how other people handled the weight of the how. In the 90s, that search led me to The X-Files. There was an intriguing story and a hot, brainy woman who knew what she was doing. I was peripherally familiar with David Duchovny from Red Shoe Diaries. Don't judge me. Then there was Gillian Anderson as Dana Scully. She was a pathologist who walked into a room with a medical degree and a flashlight, demanding a logical explanation for the impossible. She was a specialized expert who could maintain her composure and her analytical spine, even when the world around them stopped making sense. She was the logic of that entire show, but her partnership with Mulder was the essential friction. He was the why, the believer in chasing ghosts or little gray men. But Scully was the how. She provided the grounding that kept the whole operation from spinning off the rails. She didn't just take his word for things. She made him earn it with physical evidence. That dynamic where the woman isn't just a sidekick, but the one holding the map and the scalpel, was a baseline for my own expectations. But if Scully was the baseline of the 90s, my true find was Kay Scarpetta. Patricia Cornwell did something most thriller writers hadn't done. She put an unexpected character, an overlooked reality, front and center. She took the energy of Quincy M.D. and gave it a real face, a grounded reality, and she made it female. The point of no return for me was All That Remains. That book captured the atmospheric, heavy dread of the Colonial Parkway murders, and it was the first time I felt the actual physical weight of a professional toll I couldn't yet name. Cornwell didn't give me the sanitized Hollywood version of the work. She gave me the smell of the morgue. She wrote about the grit, the cold stainless steel, and the specific exhaustion of being one of the invisible cogs working while the rest of the world is tucked into bed. She talked about scrubbing the smell of formaldehyde out of her skin and hair after a long shift. And trust me, that never really comes out. To this day, I cannot use Dial antibacterial soap, because we had it in the freshman biology lab, and I will forever conflate it with the smell of formaldehyde. And when your hands smell like that after an afternoon lab, and then you go directly to dinner after, and they have a rotating menu that serves rare London broil on lab days, let's just say a lot of my classmates became vegetarians that year. But within those books, Kay Scarpetta was unapologetically clinical, authoritative, and flawed. She had to be technically perfect because the moment she wasn't, the system, the cops, the lawyers, the bureaucracy would try to eat her alive. That grit felt authentic because it was. Cornwell had based Scarpetta on Marcella Fierro, the real-life chief medical examiner of Virginia, anchoring the mystery in technical reality. Fierro was the woman behind the curtain. She was the one who showed that the job isn't just about the find. It's about standing as a sentinel for the dead and carrying that weight home. By forging the connection between a real-world powerhouse like Fierro and the character on the page grounded everything Cornwell created. It confirmed that the clinical reality of the work was exactly as heavy and as meticulous as the science demanded. This connection to the real world eventually led me to one of my favorite real-life discoveries. The novel The Body Farm was the guide. It was the first time I realized that the science I was reading about wasn't just a clever plot device. It was anchored in a literal place. Cornwell took Scarpetta out of the clinical morgue and dropped her into a field in Tennessee. Finding out that the body farm was a literal scientific facility led me directly to William Bass, and specifically to his nonfiction work, Beyond the Body Farm. This is a book I will rave about to anyone who will listen. Bass is the one who took the science out into the woods after he realized that for over a century, our understanding of the postmortem interval was mostly guesswork. In Beyond the Body Farm, Bass lays out the actual cases and the technical reality of cacophony without the Hollywood filter. He provided the scientific basis. When shows like CSI wrap pigs in blankets to illustrate insect development on a corpse, which was the scientific standard for years, Bass was performing environmental experiments on actual human corpses. Originally, he started with one unclaimed John Doe. Today, there's a waiting list for people willing to donate their bodies to his cause. Eventually, he started writing fiction himself with John Jefferson as Jefferson Bass, because he realized that to make the science accessible and make the world actually pay attention to the reality of the soil, he had to wrap the science in a narrative. Next, if Bass was about the environment and the how of the breakdown of a body in soil, Sewell Black was the bridge back to the individual. She focuses on the durability of the human record. In her work, especially her book titled All That Remains, coincidentally the same title as Cornwell's book, but where Cornwell gives us the fiction, Dame Sue Black gives us the cold, skeletal reality. She strips away all the sappy nonsense. She doesn't treat remains as a tragedy. She treats them as a cold, hard, permanent record. To her, the body is a witness. Every trauma, every repetitive motion, every environmental factor is etched into your skeletal structure. She provides clinical authority, the energy where the facts are the only thing that matters. Between Bill Bass teaching about decomposition, the soil, and the environment, and Sue Black teaching about the bones, the picture is painted. The how isn't just a mystery, it's a technical language. The cold, hard fact is that the truth of how someone lived and how they died is written in the remains, provided you're paying enough attention to read them. These are the real-life detectives solving the mysteries of real people. I love these pioneers in fiction and in science because I believe that the greatest mystery is the human body. While my husband, who was also a biology major in college, studied ecology and comparative anatomy of animals with an eye toward teaching, I studied the human body almost exclusively. It is a fascinating mystery that we still don't understand. We try, and we make great leaps forward all of the time. In the 20th century, many of these huge leaps in modern research were due to the existence of something called HeLa cells. They were an immortal cell line that allowed researchers to research the polio vaccine, experiment with gene mapping, even research COVID-19. However, the story behind these miracle cells is a horror tale to modern ethics. And this is where sociology intersects with biology. Though she remained unidentified for years, these immortal cells were harvested from a woman named Henrietta Lacks. Henrietta believed that she was receiving treatment at Johns Hopkins for her invasive cancer. However, some of the treatments she thought she was receiving were actually procedures to harvest her biological code without consent. These harvested cells were used in research that had previously been impossible, because outside of the body, normal cell cultures quickly die off. Her cells keep living, keep reproducing, allowing doctors and scientists to perform stable experiments. While Henrietta and her family lived in poverty, and even after her death, scientists and corporations profited millions from the discoveries that were impossible without her cells. It's a heartbreaking and jarring reality that makes you examine the ethics of medical research. Where do we draw the line, you know, between individual rights and ownership of our bodies, and the potential for the good of humanity as a whole? If you have any interest in science or sociology or history, I highly recommend reading this book. So we've traveled a long road today. From the snowbound tracks of the Orient Express to the literal soil of the body farm, and finally to the sterile, ethically complex incubator of a HeLa cell culture. What all of these stories have in common, whether they're found in a Harlequin romance or a peer-reviewed pathology report, is that they're all trying to solve the same mystery. Us. We're the protagonists, the victims, the investigators, and sometimes the sociological failures. That is the secret handshake of the human condition. We all have our own story, but we are also part of the collective stories of protagonists and villains and victims and antagonists and perpetrators. It's the breakfast club of the human condition. I'm just one part of a much larger team, standing alongside the architects like Francis Lee, the investigators like Joe Matthews, and the seekers like Michelle McNamara. We're all chasing the same thing from different angles. My angle just happens to be the one under the microscope. And This is the science of the story. I'm Lissa, and this is the science of murder. So today has been part one of my birthday month detour, the science of murder as entertainment. Next week, we're moving from the page to the screen. We're going to look at the medium of film and television. We'll look at the CSI effect in real-world courtrooms, and I'll share my favorite, maybe least favorite, cinematic portrayals of the laboratory and crime scene investigations. From the precision of Mindhunter to the, wait, that's not how that works. That's not how any of that works, moments and procedurals. We're gonna put Hollywood under the lens. And if you haven't already, please like and subscribe to The Science of Murder to continue learning along with me. If you found today's deep dive into the fiction and nonfiction of death fascinating, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred provider. Reviews help other science-minded true crime fans find the show, so I encourage you to tell your accomplices. I mean friends, to learn along with us. I'd love to hear your thoughts on these books or any others you'd like to suggest. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon as Science of Murder, or reach me directly at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. Stay curious, stay scientific, and join us in our next episode.